Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, July 6th, 1992, Marsha P. Johnson's body was discovered floating in the Hudson River on the west side of Manhattan near the Christopher Street piers. The police quickly ruled Johnson's death a suicide, despite the fact that close friends and community members insisted Johnson was not suicidal and that the back of her head had a massive wound in it. That was Marsha's death. Johnson was born in 1945 in Elizabeth, New Jersey. By the 70s, Johnson had changed her name and become one of the most prominent members of the burgeoning drag queen scene in New York City. Johnson initially used the moniker Black Marsha, but later decided on the name Marsha P. Johnson. I love this, getting Johnson from the restaurant Howard Johnson's on 42nd Street and saying that the P stood for Pay It No Mind. That is how you come up with a name. Johnson was photographed by Andy Warhol, was referred to as the mayor of Christopher Street, and depending on what account you read, was a key figure in the protests at the Stonewall Inn that kicked off much of the early gay liberation fight in New York City. So here to discuss the remarkable life and death of Marsha P. Johnson are, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter-Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
So, Nikki, I guess we should just say right off the bat, in preparing for this show, trying to figure out what pronouns to use for Marsha, the Times obituary uses she, other places seem to avoid pronouns, and I think the ambiguity of that is instructive in terms of an understanding of when Marsha P. Johnson was coming up. There really wasn't a lot of language around this because it was early days.
Right. I mean, certainly there was some debate about how you talk about yourself, but this was an era in which people didn't really use the term transsexual or transgender, and debates over pronouns, which have become much more part of a national debate in the last 5 to 10 years, they just weren't available. And so, you know, we're trying to use the kind of care around language that we have grown accustomed to. But it just wasn't at the center of the debate back in the 1960s and 70s as Johnson is coming up. And so we just have to muddle through and acknowledge the challenge here.
And I suppose in part that's because the debates at that time were much more fundamental. About fundamental questions of, you know, humanity, right, Kelly?
Well, yeah, there was very much a he-she narrative. The idea of they just did not compute, or gender non-conforming binary was just not also something that was a part of the lexicon. But it's funny, I hear most people refer to Marsha P. Johnson as she. In my class, when I'm teaching about her in my Black Women's History class, I refer to her as she. But I think it's okay to also say they as well, because that's language that my students are familiar with.
Mm-hmm. So, Kelly, I mean, on that point, why is Marsha P. Johnson in your curriculum?
I teach Marsha P. Johnson because she lives a really remarkable and also sad and tragic life in a lot of ways. I mean, remarkable in the sense that she's so audacious and bold in her identity and her stance and really taking up the fight for the LGBTQ community. You know, she's at the forefront of Stonewall and is so outspoken about securing rights and privileges for LGBTQ people that I felt like she was someone my students needed to know. And I also wanted my students to understand that even though we have a movement around LGBTQ, there was still racism in that, and there was still classism within that, and there's still a divide even within that community, that these aren't monoliths. And so it's important for us to tease out even the names who are marginalized within the marginalized.
Yeah, and I think that gets to the point you were talking about earlier, Jody, that yes, there was a very basic fight for the recognition of a person's humanity, regardless of their sexuality. But that was also a fight in which white cis men were more likely to be recognized as human than somebody like Marsha P. Johnson. And so those fissures and the kind of, you know, just erasure that happened in introducing the history of LGBTQ people into the narrative, there's been real work, I think, in recent mm-hmm. years to make sure that the fuller picture is included.
Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So one example of that is the Stonewall Uprising is in the summer of 69. A year later, in the summer of 1970, is when there's what is often thought of as the first gay pride rally in New York City. Mm-hmm. And during that, you know, even by that point, the role potentially of drag queens, particularly black drag queens, had already started to be erased. Johnson did march in that. But then by 1973, just a few years later, there was a big fight that where there was an attempt to ban drag queens from marching in the gay rights parade. And so we see that there are debates and there's a dynamic within the community as well.
And this is an important legal thing as well, because one of the things that people were being checked for at Stonewall when the police raid happened was if they were wearing the clothing of the opposite sex. So the law was that if you had more than two or three pieces of clothing traditionally worn by the opposite sex, then you were officially cross-dressing and therefore you were breaking the law. And so transvestites, crossdressers, however they were called at the time, had an extra layer of legal vulnerability. And so I think that's also another reason why Johnson becomes an important part of the story again.
Yeah. And even within her community, there's pushback from white gay men who don't want the drag narrative or drag women in front of their campaign. And so they feel like it will make things harder for them. And, you know, Marsha P. Johnson was, again, so outspoken. She was like, hey, listen, this is about all of us. This is not just about right. one sect of our group. So her and a lot of other, I think of Sylvia Rivera, a lot of other LGBTQ women are really pushing to expand the narrative of how we would think of LGBTQ to include lesbians, to include trans women, to include just queer people, because so much of the movement had been, I think, dominated by white gay men.
And dominated by, to a certain extent, respectability politics.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so there's a gradual move away from that. You know, by the late 1960s, you don't have as big of a presence of something like the Mattachine Society, which was like everybody dress in suits and look respectable. Mm-hmm. But you still have a fight going on, and that would go on for decades, over how respectable the public-facing side of gay liberation was.
So, you know, I think we're painting a picture certainly of Johnson as a colorful, amazing, warm character, but also an activist. And it does get at something I think about a lot, which is, you know, I think in a lot of communities, if you are going to try and be yourself at a certain moment in history, you actually have no choice but to be an activist. And in some way, I find that inspiring. I also find it incredibly tragic that mm-hmm. people can't just be themselves. Maybe Marsha P. Johnson wants to just put her head down and live her life. Mm-hmm. And instead, she has to live this life of activism. Mm-hmm. And that continues, and I'm glad she did, to be clear. But, you know, that goes through the 70s, but it also continues into the 80s and into the early 90s, where, you know, this flow from a basic liberation, humanity activism starts to morph into AIDS activism. Mm-hmm. And she is part of ACT UP, which is one of the early agitating groups in the early days of the AIDS crisis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. ACT UP is huge. And in that movement, her and Rivera, I mentioned Sylvia Rivera before, they established Star House, which is a shelter for gay and lesbian and trans kids. They pay for the rent with their work as sex workers. And they are really using this movement to talk about how this health epidemic is hitting their community the hardest. And people were not paying attention. They were so dismissive of the plight that was hitting the LGBT community. So, and ACT UP takes on a lot of really controversial, I don't know if we're going to cover an episode on them, but there's so many demonstrations yeah. that they do. And I'm reminded of all this too, because I just finished the third and final episode of Pose. Like, I've been watching mm-hmm. Pose. It's such a good show. Something I don't even think Marsha herself could have imagined, such a celebrated and highly acclaimed show that's all about trans women and their struggles, and ACT UP in particular.
Yeah, ACT UP is definitely something we should spend an episode talking about, but it's important to add Star House into the mix because I think, you know, for people who think of ACT UP as a kind of street theater activism, as something that's trying to draw attention, but that's in the public imagination sometimes all they do, right? They're out there protesting. They're protesting Pat Robertson and Pat Buchanan in the 80s and 90s. They're protesting the Catholic Church, and they're known for being controversial, that there are these very grounded service-based mm-hmm. activities that are happening as part of that same movement and as part of what the ACT UP activists are doing as well.
Well, that's such a good point. And it makes me think of, you know, this last year and this moment we're living in now, we have Black Lives Matter agitation, mm-hmm. right? But then this rise of mutual aid societies around the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same dynamic, right? And that's how movements work, right? There's mm-hmm. agitation, there's theater, there's community building, and there's the on the ground sort of human to human connection mm-hmm. And taking care of each other. And all of that was happening here. As I said, you know, if you were a gay person in this period, you know, and the other thing I'm reminded of here is, you know, my parents were born in 1945. Like, this is not ancient history, mm-hmm. right? And so this is someone who lived a life, and through the 70s into the 80s into the 90s, you are going to walk that path from basic fights, Stonewall, Celebration, legal battles into the AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. Like, it is just no choice but to live this incredibly dynamic and varied life.
But also a life of hardship and a life of violence and a life of bullying. And I mean, right. that really encapsulates, I think, so much of her death as well. I mean, in that, you know, the police had ruled it a suicide, which made no sense. And then there was a huge push to sort of, you know, open up her case again. And then in 2002, December of 2002, they claim, okay, well, we're going to move her death from suicide to undetermined. But there still hasn't been a pivot to really look at her death as a homicide. And I think so much of that is important when we think about how Black trans women in particular face violence and have much higher mortality rates when we think about their longevity. So many of them don't get to live to be old people because of the violence that's endemic to their identity.
Yeah, which is why these later projects are so important, that as both the gay rights movement, but as the trans rights movement gains more visibility and more acceptance, they're able to leverage some of that new political power to try to right an injustice right. that had been done, mm-hmm. you know, in the early 90s.
Right. And so there have been, over the years, efforts to really get to the bottom of what happened here. You mentioned the 2002 investigation, which reclassified it. In 2012, there was some activism that sort of reopened the investigation. Then again in 2016, some activists went back and re-interviewed folks. I don't know if we will ever know exactly what happened, but I think the efforts to keep this open and keep digging are really important. Again, not that long ago, mm-hmm. You know, still living history. So we'll see. A couple other sort of more recent notes. In 2019, Johnson was on the inaugural 50 American Pioneers, Trailblazers, and Heroes included on the National LGBTQ Wall of Honor. And unfortunately, this got announced in February 2020, where I think maybe the news got buried a little bit by the events of what happened soon thereafter. But there will soon be a park in New York City named in honor of Marsha P. Johnson.
I think that's wonderful. I think it's wonderful to be able to have spaces like these. I know people like to poo-poo symbolic change, but I do think that it matters to be able to play in a park named after a Black trans woman activist. And I don't think that's something, again, she could have imagined for herself as well, that she would be celebrated in this way. But these symbolic things do have substance to them as well, and they do matter, and they make a difference in terms of how we normalize these identities so that we don't have to face the same battles and struggles that she did.
Right. Hear, hear. Especially given who parks are typically named
generally after. Generally named after, yes.
Yeah. This is good. Move again, in the right direction.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And again, a lot of Johnson's community, you know, is still around. And so it's it's not just a gesture. It's actually a meaningful act for people who are still living in New York City, who still are part of this community, are still fighting this fight. The park is on the East River. It's in Brooklyn. It's in Williamsburg. Beautiful park. I've been there. But next time you go there, I think, I don't know when the plaque is going to go up, but someday you will walk in that park and you will see the plaque. You will read the plaque and maybe someone will discover the story of Marsha P. Johnson. Okay. Let's end it there. Nicole Hammer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. You can get in touch with us with any questions or comments or ideas for the show. Email us thisdaypod@gmail.com, or you can find a form at thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Why are you here today?
Darling, I want my gay rights now. I think it's about time the gay brothers and sisters got their rights, and especially the women.
Radiotopia from PR.